So what are some of the most important questions in life? Some of the most important questions in life. Like, is cereal a soup? I mean, it's worth considering. There's something there. If animals could talk, which one would be the rudest? We know it'd be cats. I mean, without a doubt, right? Is a hot dog a sandwich? Who cares? I mean, it doesn't matter to me, you know? Look, I had two chili dogs from the Simba Express convenience store this week, and I didn't care whether it was a sandwich or not. I loved them. They were good. What about, is there a time limit on whether a fortune cookie prediction comes true or not? You know, how long? You know, a week? A month? I mean, how long is that prediction? What about this one? How can something be new and improved? That math doesn't work, right? If it's new, you didn't improve on anything. It's new. And of course, one of the most obvious, why in the world does the Easter Bunny carry eggs? Rabbits don't lay eggs. What in the world? Why are there eggs involved in this at all? It makes no sense. Look, there's a lot of important questions in life. And in a sense, sometimes the questions in and of themselves are what's most important. I think it was philosopher John E. Gasparini that said that the best way to measure someone is by the questions, not by the answers. In other words, when you're trying to evaluate someone's character, many times it makes more sense to look and see how crucial and even curious are the questions that they ask. How do they think? But there's one question that's more crucial than curious. One question that's more important than all the rest. And it's a question that doesn't just add value to someone's character as you're trying to evaluate them and measure them up, but it actually defines that person, mind, body, and spirit. Well, what kind of question is that? Well, we begin a new series today, and the series is called, Who Are You? And that is the important question we'll be dealing with, the crucial question we'll be dealing with. And as we deal with it, we need to have this sense of anticipation that as we journey through this, there's going to be a blend of conviction and confidence. Because knowingly or unknowingly, every human being of any age desperately always needs that combination of conviction and confidence. Apostle Paul is going to help us create that blend as we connect with his letter to some folks in the ancient city known as Ephesus. And Paul was not writing this letter from the comfort of a spring break beach destination somewhere. No, he was writing this letter from the discomfort of some level of Roman imprisonment. In other words, as we walk through this series together, what we're going to discover is not a bunch of fluffy religious memes that we can post, but we're actually going to look at something that is designed to create real hope, real conviction, and real confidence in our lives. Today's message, as we begin, is titled, It's a Question of Death. And we're going to be looking in Ephesians chapter 2, listen as Paul begins with verse 1. Ephesians 2, verse 1, he writes, And you were dead in your offenses and sins. Dead in offenses, dead in trespasses, dead in sins. Now, at first glance, this makes no sense, right? I mean, if I am offending someone, if I am trespassing on someone's property, if I'm sinning against someone, well, I'm in the process of doing something. So how can I be offending, trespassing, and sinning, be alive to do those things, and at the same time be dead? Well, death is the opposite of life. That means when someone is dead, there is no life. And so when we use the word dead, we're saying no life. So it can't be that Paul's talking about physical death, right? Because if you're physically dead, you can't offend and trespass and sin. So what Paul's talking about is spiritual death. He's talking about your spirit, the innermost part of who you are, the deepest part of your existence being dead to God, having no life with the one true God. And if a person's spirit is dead to God, that means that in many different ways, that their spirit is being completely controlled by offenses and trespasses and sins. So if we're asking the question, who are you? One of the most defining and demanding things you must also ask is this: are you dead? Is the spirit of who you are dead to God? The innermost part of who you are, the deepest part of your existence, is it dead to God? Are you dead in sin? Now, someone may be thinking, well, I don't know if I'm dead in sin. I mean, I've never murdered anybody. I mean, I've only barely cheated on my taxes. I mean, I'm not that bad a person. You know, maybe I don't have any sin in my life. Unfortunately, that's not true. Every single person that has ever been born is born with the virus of sin before they're even born. They've already caught the virus of sin. No one ever had to teach a child how to throw a tantrum. Nobody ever had to teach an innocent, precious little two-year-old how to hit someone, kick someone, bite someone, or throw dirt on someone's face on a playground. And no one had to teach any of us how to sin. We all came out of the womb knowing how to sin and in many ways loving to sin. So where do we catch the virus of sin? Well, we caught it because it spread from the first person who ever lived. You see, Adam didn't just take some fruit that had been stolen off a tree. No, by definition, he desired and loved and preferred and treasured and honored the wrong, rebellious, disobedient thing more than he loved, desired, preferred, treasured, and honored the one true God, the one who loved him, the one who fearfully and wonderfully made him. So in a sense, what was happening with the first sin was that for some reason, Adam decided he could do a better job as God over his life than God. Does that sound familiar? Does that not far too often sound exactly how we function on a daily basis? And all the crucial and curious moments of life, do we not somehow in our mind go, I think I can handle this better. God, I'll call you if I need you. Paul was writing to some folks in Rome, and he said this about Adam. Romans 5, verse 12. Just as through one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all mankind, because all sinned. Now, someone immediately is probably thinking, well, I don't like that. I shouldn't have to be blamed for what Adam did. That's just not fair. Well, it may not sound fair, but the fall of humanity through Adam, the spread of original sin, is the only thing that makes rational, logical sense. In fact, when you look at the state of how everything is in the world right now, the fall of humanity, the spread of original sin, is the only thing that makes logical, rational sense. Tim Keller says this: if you don't believe in the fall of humanity as a single historical event, what is your alternative? You may posit that some human beings began to slowly turn away from God, all exercising their free wills. But then how did sin spread? Was it only by bad example? We do not learn sin from others. We inherit a sin nature. And we'll fight against this mentally. In fact, we'll think of something that our grandparents or our parents or our great Aunt Susie or somebody believed, and we'll go, ah. But when you look at the whole of Scripture, the consistent message is that we inherit this sinful nature from the very beginning till now. Because if we are inherently good people and just every now and then do something wrong, then why didn't Eve take the kids and take off? Why didn't she get away from Adam, who wasn't going to obey God, and just they went somewhere to go start a good, kind life? Or what about the grandkids? Why didn't eventually the grandkids, why didn't they break off, start over, get away from all that early family trauma, and just start a new life, a new, kind, good life? Someone may still be thinking, well, okay, every now and then I do something wrong. I'll admit it. But I mean, I grew up in church, and I wasn't a bad kid. And I don't think I'm that bad of a person now. Someone once said that if sin were blue, we would be blue all over. Part of us would be dark blue. Part of us would be sky blue. Part of us would be light blue. And we could go through every part of who we are and the whole color wheel of blue, and we would be able to spread out blue everywhere. Someone may say, well, I'm colorblind, so I can't see blue. So, you know, maybe there is no sin in my life. C.S. Lewis gives the picture of sin as if we have rats in our cellar, rats in our basement, and we flip the light on. This is what he says. If there are rats in the cellar, you are most likely to see them if you go in very suddenly. But the suddenness does not create the rats. It only prevents them from hiding. The rats are always there in the cellar, but if you go in shouting and noisily, they will have taken cover before you switch on the light. In other words, every single one of us know how to hide sin. We know how to act like sin isn't there. We know how to clear the browsers. We know how to delete the pictures. We know how to act like we didn't say that on the phone. We know how to delete the text. We know how to make sure we never use words in text, just emojis, or never even respond. See, we know how to hide sin, and we know how to ignore sin. But there is no ultimate ignoring of sin. It is there. No one is without offenses. No one is without trespasses. No one is without sin. Whether we turn the light on or not, offenses and trespasses and sins, they're always there. But what's the difference? I mean, there's a few words here. What's the difference? Well, let's categorize offenses and trespasses. Those are kind of just like what they sound like. It's like stumbling into somewhere you shouldn't be. You know, like you didn't see the sign that says no trespassing. But does it matter? Does it matter that you didn't see the sign? If you're on the land, you're still trespassing whether you saw the sign or not. So there's a sense that trespassing and offenses could be somewhat stumbling into something. But in a deeper and more real sense, offenses and trespasses is something that describes rebellion. You know exactly that the sign's there, but you're going hunting and fishing there anyway. You know exactly what you should and shouldn't be doing, but you don't really like what you've been told to should and shouldn't. So you decide you're going to make your own version of right and wrong because by all means you think that you know best. That sound familiar to any of us, making our own version, our own definitions of right and wrong? Sin, though, is something different. It's completely missing the mark. It is failure to be perfect. Failure to be perfect. In other words, failure to meet the ultimate universal standards that are good and right and just that have been created by God. We don't meet them. No person has ever perfectly met them. No person will ever perfectly meet them. We all fall short of the glory of God. No one is without offenses. No one is without trespasses. No one is without sins. That virus, those viruses, if you will, we all catch. We all catch even before we're born. They have spread everywhere to everyone. Now, there are a lot of people that say that's just a bunch of hippy-dippy religious baloney. You know, that's not true. Well, let's say it is true. If it is just a bunch of baloney, if the fall of humanity, the original sin, the spread of original sin, if it's all a fairy tale, then why are there cemeteries? Why is there death? Someone said that every grave in a cemetery is like a mute, quiet, unspoken piece of evidence of the rule and reign and existence of sin from Adam until right now and even beyond. Here's the interesting thing about this, though. Paul's not even trying to convince us necessarily of sin. His primary purpose here is not to convince us of sin. It's not even necessarily to convict us of sin. His primary purpose in this one little part of verse 1 is to say this, that sin and death are connected. You can't disconnect them. That sin is the reason there is death. They're connected physically, spiritually, and eternally. Sin and death are connected. So again, we repeat, if you are asking the question, who are you? Who am I? One of the most defining and demanding things you have to ask underneath that question is this, am I dead? Is your spirit, the innermost part of who you are, the deepest part of your existence, is it dead to God? Are you dead in your sin? And why does that matter? Why does your answer to that question matter? Jeff Thomas says this, a weak person could be made strong, right? I mean, you can go to the gym, you can work it out. I was reading something last week about my role in the universe here, and it labeled me as a knowledge worker. And it was saying that a knowledge worker is different than other kind of workers. Other kind of workers do amazing things for people all the time. But I wrote in the margins of the book, it would be kind of like the difference in me and a personal trainer. If I were a personal trainer, which is just funny me even thinking about it because I'm not much of a trainer, but if I were a personal trainer, I could help you. Oh man, I could help you. Man, we could shed some pounds, we can build some muscle. But here's what I can't do. I can't keep you from dying. I can't. No matter how great of a personal trainer I am, you may still be exercising at 90, walking at 100, lifting weights at 110, I don't know. But I can't make you live forever, no matter how great of a fitness worker I am. And likewise, as a knowledge worker, I can't keep you alive. I mean, I can't, through what I do, keep you alive. But the knowledge that I'm working to communicate, that knowledge can keep you alive. Because that knowledge is knowledge for your spirit. And when you can't work out anymore, when you can't make it to the gym, when life comes to an end, that's when your life begins. If you have the knowledge and salvation of God. I got to be honest, it kind of helped me going, okay, I'm not wasting my time, all right? I'm doing all right. I'm doing okay. A weak person could be made strong. A deceiver could be taught the truth. A person loving darkness might be educated to love light. A sick person can be nursed back to health. But a corpse? What are you going to do with a corpse? You can't just train it back to life. There is nothing more terrifying in this life, and for that matter, in the life to come, than being dead in your sin today. Why is it so terrifying? Because you don't know it. This is what Paul was writing to some folks in the ancient city of Corinth. He said this, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 14. But a natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. And he cannot understand them because they are spiritually discerned. So a natural person, what Paul's describing here, is a spiritually dead person. It's the same kind of person and thing he's talking about in Ephesians 2:1. They're alive in the sense that they can cut out of work early and go get some coffee, or cut the grass on Saturday, or use a Flowbee to cut their hair. You know, they're alive in those senses. But they are also cut off from understanding the glory and the majesty and the beauty and the love and the mercy of God. The most real and fantastic things in the universe, they're cut off from. They're dead to those things. They can't understand them. The story's told about a big outdoor youth rally, and as the speaker was speaking, eventually one young man jumped up and interrupted him and shouted out. He goes, "Hey, you know, you're talking about this burden of sin, this weight of sin, this load of sin. I don't feel it. I don't feel any weight. I don't feel any burden. I don't feel a load of sin in my life. Man, if it was the end of the world as we know it, I'd feel fine right now. I'm good." And then, as public protesting often does, it puffed him up with a little more pride, you know. And he was like, "Okay, here we go." And he shouted out again. He goes, "Hey, by the way, how heavy is sin? Is it 80 pounds? Is it 10 pounds? How heavy is sin? How would I even know?" And the speaker very calmly replied back and said, "Here's a question. If I put a 400-pound weight on the chest of a dead man, would he feel it?" The young man said, "No, he wouldn't feel it. He's dead." And the speaker said, "Likewise, someone who does not feel the load of sin is spiritually dead. They don't feel it." Are you dead like that? Do you not feel the load of sin, the weight of sin, the burden of sin? Now, that question begs another question. If someone's spiritually dead and they can't understand, how can they feel the load of sin? If you're spiritually dead, how are you going to spiritually feel the load of sin? It's a good question. We don't know the answer. In fact, it's the most terrifying and at the same time the most terrific mystery in the universe. How can dead people hear the truth about God? How can they feel the load of sin if they're spiritually dead and they can't understand? We can't explain it in human terms. Here's what we do know. One day Jesus was talking to some super religious folks, and this is what he said in John 6:44. "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him." And we also know what Paul says just a few sentences later in verse 5, Ephesians 2:5. He says this about what the mercy of God is able to do. "Even when we were dead, God made us alive together with Christ." Even when we were dead, God, through his mercy, made us alive together with Christ. The one true living God can draw people to Jesus, and he can make them become spiritually alive. God can quicken a person's spirit. He can move them from being dead in sin to being alive with Christ. Somehow, in ways that we can't explain, the weight of the load of sin, we begin to feel it on our chest, and we also feel it removed. All in the same instance, it seems. We feel the chains of sin, and at the exact same time, we feel that our chains are gone. Rescue and repentance somehow pass each other in the hall at the same exact time. And all of that passing is energized and created and accomplished by the mercy of God. In one moment, we are dead in sin, and in the same moment, all of a sudden, we are alive to God. How? What does that look like in real life? I have no earthly idea, and yet at the same time, I have every earthly idea. How? Well, see, I was raised in a home that promoted the gospel. Not a perfect home, but it promoted the gospel. And I was raised in a church that promoted the gospel. It wasn't a perfect church, but it promoted the gospel. And I had friends and families that promoted the gospel. They weren't perfect, but they promoted the gospel. And I had a community in a very real way that promoted the gospel. Wasn't perfect, but it promoted the gospel. But I was dead in my offenses and trespasses and sins. The gospel was all around me. But I was dead in my sin. And then one day, about a week before I started the sixth grade, my youth pastor had a conversation with me. And he asked me some questions. And as we talked, man, I tossed around some super arrogant, catchy church phrases. You know? Oh, yeah, man, I had all the answers. And I pushed back on the communication of the gospel to me in that moment, because I thought I was fine. I wasn't that bad a kid. Gosh, only thing Pat Welsh ever had to get on to me for was not taking out the trash. I was a great kid, you know? Everybody liked me. I wasn't that bad. I don't know about all that right now. Arrogant, cocky Southern Baptist church kid. And I walked out of that room. It was an upstairs room. And I didn't get down the first flight of stairs before I was troubled. And by the time I got to the bottom of the stairs, I was really troubled. And I started walking. Really, I started pacing. And I paced up and down this little side street next to that building. And I began to say, God, am I saved? I don't know. God, I need you to save me. I need you to change what's happening. I don't know what's going on, but I need you to save me. And something happened. I can't explain it. All I know is I suddenly felt the load of my sin on my chest. And then in the same moment, I felt that load removed. That conversation had turned to conviction. And that conviction had turned to conversion. And that conversion had turned to confidence. A confidence that has never been broken. Has it been beaten? Oh, yeah. Has it been bruised? Oh, yeah. Has it been battered? Oh, yeah. But my confidence in Christ has never been broken. Why? Because I didn't make myself alive. I don't have that ability. And so on Pine Avenue in Garden City, South Carolina, as an arrogant Southern Baptist church kid, God rescued and redeemed and changed me in a moment. Did I understand all of it then? No. Do I understand all of it now? No. But I know in that moment, on that day, I didn't make myself alive. God drew me and He made me alive. And from that moment 42 years ago, I've never sinned since. Of course, that's not true. And here's why. But this is what happens. Love this. Someone put it this way. To be dead to sin does not mean that a believer is totally unable to sin. I'm totally able to sin, okay? And I do, a lot, is what it says. It means that Christ has separated him from the slavery of sin and set him apart for a specific purpose. Who am I? I am a sinful scoundrel from North Augusta, South Carolina, who has been separated from the slavery of sin. And I've been made alive to a specific purpose. What purpose? I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. But here's what I know. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I once was blind, but now I see. I once was dead in my sin. And I have been made alive with Christ. Paul said this, and you were dead in your offenses and sins. I were. And now I'm not. What about you? Were you or are you? Who